Greetings, this is Bob Noya, Editor-in-Chief of Sky and Telescope Magazine. I'm on the phone today with Dr. Jim Bell, a distinguished planetary scientist at Arizona State University. Jim is a specialist in both asteroids and Mars. He authored the article about Vesta in the November 2011 issue of Sky and Telescope. He is also the leader of the panoramic camera team for the Mars exploration rovers Spirit and Opportunity. Besides his scientific accomplishments, Jim is a prolific popularizer of astronomy and planetary science, and he is this year's recipient of the Carl Sagan Medal. Jim, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, it's great to be here, Bob. It's great to be chatting with you and the readers of Sky and Telescope. I started reading the magazine when I was like 9 or 10 years old, so it's really exciting.
Great, especially your articles appearing in our 70th anniversary issue.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Yeah. Now, at the time we're talking in late August, Dawn has been in orbit around Vesta for about a month. Are you aware of any new results from the mission since you wrote your Sky and Telescope article that our readers should be aware of?
Well, the team has gotten into this sort of groove now of taking pictures and other measurements as they prepared to sort of slowly lower the orbit closer to the surface. So they've started releasing their image of the week, or in some cases image of the day has been starting to come out. Some of the features that we've seen so far, these craters, these grooves, the gigantic gouge in the south polar region, they're just really spectacular. And so as a geologist, you just start to drool and say, I want to see it at a higher resolution. And in fact, they are getting down. At the same time, in the background, what I call the squiggly line instruments, the spectrometer and the neutron gamma ray spectrometer and the infrared spectrometer are building up these data sets that just take a long time to build up. So my expectation is over the next couple of months, we'll start to see some of the results of those investigations too.
Now, Vesta's composition differs considerably from that of other asteroids, and in particular, it seems to be made of more volcanic materials. Do we know what it was about Vesta's formation that makes it so different from other asteroids?
Well, not exactly, but that's one of the main goals of the Dawn mission, is to figure that out. Many planetary scientists hypothesize that Vesta may be one of the few remaining large planetesimals, the building blocks that went into the terrestrial planets, the Mercury, Venus, Earth, Moon, Mars. And many of those, of course, were subsumed into the planets early in the history of the formation of the solar system 4.6 billion years ago. Many of them were destroyed by subsequent collisions, and little pieces of them are still floating around the solar system as smaller asteroids. Some of them fall to the Earth as meteorites as well, but there seem to be very few large ones remaining, and Vesta may be special in that way.
You also mentioned that Vesta must have been internally heated in its early history, which allowed it to differentiate into a core, mantle, and crust. Is there evidence that other large asteroids have also differentiated into distinct layers, or might Vesta be unique in that aspect?
Well, Vesta might be unique in that it still remains intact as a differentiated asteroid, and we think we know that's the case because of the kinds of rocks and minerals that you see on its surface from the telescopic spectroscopy and hopefully soon from Dawn spectrometers are the same kinds of volcanic rocks and minerals that you find on all the rest of the terrestrial planets. It implies that the heavy stuff is sunk to the middle and the lighter stuff is floated to the top, and there have been volcanic eruptions of material onto the surface. Now, we know that process has happened on probably many other asteroids in the past that have since been blown up to bits because the meteorite collection on the Earth contains pieces of ancient asteroid cores and ancient asteroid mantles and ancient asteroid crusts. So we know that these planetesimals, small planets like Vesta, did exist in the past, did differentiate, and most of them appear to have been destroyed or swept up over the history of the solar system.
Now, you mentioned in the article that you deign to call Vesta a planet. Why is it that you still consider Vesta to be a planet rather than maybe an asteroid or a minor planet?
Well, you know, it's a fun kind of debate that astronomers have been having the last few years, precipitated by the whole issue of Pluto and the discovery of more Pluto-like objects in the Kuiper Belt. And I think every planetary scientist, every astronomer has a personal definition of what it means to be a planet. The official definition of the IAU is sort of skewed by the folks who think about the way objects orbit and the way they move through the solar system and whether they happen to be in orbit around another object or independently around the sun or if they cleared out their zone. My definition is more of a geologist's rather than an astronomer's definition. I look at individual objects and say, has that object grown big enough when it was accreting early in the history of the solar system to have enough mass, enough gravity to make itself essentially circularized, and to have had a really interesting lifetime over the history of the solar system? Have there been volcanic eruptions? Has it differentiated? Does it have an atmosphere? You know, for example, Jupiter's moon Ganymede is larger than the planet Mercury. Why isn't Ganymede a planet? To me, it is. I think Vesta and probably Ceres and maybe a few other large asteroids would fit my category of having been large enough to have had really interesting dynamic processes during their history and be worthy of being called a planet.
Right. You're not going to get an argument from me on that, that's for sure. And you also mentioned that scientists are interested in Vesta because of what it might tell us about planet formation. What are some of the specific things that may shed light on how Earth and the other planets formed?
For example, what we've been talking about, this idea that that Vesta is differentiated, that it didn't get warm enough early in its history to segregate into a core, mantle, and a crust, that's a hypothesis. That's really just a hypothesis, and that can be tested with a bunch of the data from Dawn, especially the spectroscopic data sets, compositional data sets, but also the high-resolution imaging and just understanding geologic context. If evidence can be found that really back that up and support it, then it probably indicates that there was a whole bunch of material out there in the early solar system that went into the terrestrial planets that was, for example, radioactive or in some way had enough heat from formation or accretion to make these small bodies relatively warm. And all that initial heat and energy went into the planet, the terrestrial planets, as they were forming. The compositional data will tell us something about the starting material that went into the planets. You know, there's a lot to learn about our own home and other planets like the Earth.
And speaking of other planets, Dawn's next target is the largest asteroid in the main belt called Ceres. In fact, it's big enough to be spherical, as we see in the HST images. What are you and other scientists hoping to learn about this large asteroid once Dawn arrives in 2015?
Well, like Vesta, the expectation is that Ceres has had a very interesting geologic history. We can already tell from the space telescope images that there are bright, dark places. There's probably interesting geologic landforms. No doubt there'll be impact craters, etc. One of the differences between Vesta and Ceres is that the telescope spectrometer measurements from ground-based data mostly show evidence of hydrated minerals. And those kinds of materials, they require water in that environment to form. Now, whether it's ice because of the distance in the outer solar system or the main belt, or whether it was subsurface liquid water, who knows? But there seems to have been water in that environment, and that might be directly relevant to what we were just talking about. Are objects like Ceres the kinds of things that went into building the terrestrial planets, endowing them with these wet mantles that then can outgas to form oceans or atmospheres? Or is there something particularly bizarre about Ceres that we don't understand? You know, recently astronomers have discovered main belt comets, you know, comets in the main belt. What the heck's going on there? Everybody said they're too close to the sun to have significant volatiles. Well, Ceres is right along that, you know, close to that so-called snow line in our solar system where we think that closer into the sun, maybe everything's going to be dry and rocky. Farther away, it's going to be icy. It's a really good test case to understand the way that these volatile materials are distributed in small bodies.
Now, given the success of Dawn's ion engines, do you think we'll see future planetary missions using ion propulsion?
I would expect that to be the case. There's, you know, it's just a really elegant solution for a lot of missions that help you sort of realize a little bit of cost savings because you don't need to bring as much chemical propellant with you, which often leads to having to use a bigger rocket because of more mass. It can, these things turn out to be stable over long durations. It can help reduce the risk of planetary missions, especially into the outer solar system, where we might have this rocket that stays cold for 7, 8, 10 years, and then it has to fire perfectly at its destination. Otherwise, you won't go into orbit, for example. So instead of having to take that risk, just slowly carve the orbit over time with these ion engines. So there are a lot of potential advantages with systems like this for some missions. Other missions still will require chemical propulsion for various specific applications, but I think missions like Dawn and others like Hayabusa that have used these kinds of ion propulsion technologies are really opening the door for a new class of planetary missions.
Now let's turn now to Mars. Earlier this year, NASA officially declared an end to Spirit's mission, but do you think there's any chance that we'll be able to reestablish communications with Spirit, or do you think it really is over?
Well, they've stopped listening, so there really is, there doesn't seem to be any particularly strong hope that I think we'll magically start working again. So I think most of us on the team have accepted the fact that absolutely great and comprehensive effort was made to try to regain communication, but it just didn't work out. So Spirit's mission is over.
But, you know, we still have opportunity on the other side of Mars. And on August 9th, it arrived at the edge of Endeavour Crater after a very long trek. And with a diameter of nearly 14 miles, Endeavour is by far the largest crater explored up close. What is the plan for the coming months? I mean, are you and your colleagues going to try to direct the rover inside the crater and perhaps even eventually drive it all the way down to the floor of the crater?
So, not immediately, no. The goal really has been to get to the rim of the crater for about the last 3 years, and we've been in this kind of crazy drive, occasionally stop and look at some meteorites, occasionally stop and look at some small craters, drive. And now, like you said, just in the last month, the whole tenor of the mission has changed again. In fact, it's like having a new mission. We got to the rim of Endeavour Crater. Right now, the rover is parked very close to a small crater called Odyssey Crater that is on some of the rim materials, and it's excavated some of the rim materials for us. So we're driving around looking at some of the boulders and outcrops and ejecta that have been lifted up out of the Endeavour rim materials by Odyssey Crater, and everything is kind of slowed down because when you need to use the instruments on the rover's arm, that takes time. So we've got to our preferred destination, and we prefer this destination on the rim because that's where we see some really interesting mineral signatures from orbit. We don't have to go down into the crater just yet. We can see them right along the rim. And the specifically interesting things are these deposits of clay minerals. Clay minerals on Mars, just like on the Earth, require liquid water to form. And so neither Spirit nor Opportunity has investigated clays on the surface of Mars directly yet. It's a major goal for MSL, which is launching the Curiosity rover, which is launching in November. So what we learned from Opportunity about studying clays, how to find them, what their surface expression is, that is going to fold right into the MSL team, hopefully, for their mission in Gale Crater, which also has clays. Mm-hmm. So it's a really exciting time, Bob. We've gotten back into the science mode instead of the driving mode. We're taking all kinds of interesting squiggly line measurements and some great pictures if you're following along on the JPL or the PanCam website. And we're just going to keep driving and driving.
Yeah. And how would you characterize the health of Opportunity? I mean, might it be able to continue its mission for many years to come?
So we continue to be, as we have been in the last 7 years, in this mode where nothing obvious is degrading or wearing out or winding down except for the bits on the rock grinding tool, the rock abrasion tool, the RAD. We know that we've only got a few really good drills left in those drill bits. And so that's a resource that's being very carefully preserved. And we'll probably use that resource sometime in the next weeks to month or so in this environment that we're in now. where the rocks are seem to be worthy of drilling into. But that doesn't really have anything to do with the lifetime of the rover. That's a consumable, if you want to think about it that way. There's nothing really that is, you know, degrading or wearing out or showing signs of imminent failure. So it's great. We're just going to keep going as long as we possibly can.
Yeah, and you mentioned, too, we have the launch of another rover coming up in just a few months, Curiosity. I should note that at this very time, I'm editing a feature article for our December issue by Emily Lakdawalla about the Curiosity mission. So that'll be nice to have that back-to-back with your Vesta article.
Definitely. And, you know, we're excited about that. Curiosity is going to Gale Crater, which is a big hole in the ground right along the boundary between the ancient southern highlands and the younger northern lowlands, and in the middle of Gale, and Gale's about 150 kilometers wide, and in the middle of it there's this 5-kilometer-high mountain of layered rocks, and carved into that mountain are these channels and canyons, and they're wonderful mineral deposits down at the base, and we're going to land off to the side of that mountain in a relatively safe spot, and spend a few months driving over into those mineral deposits and layered rocks, and the landscape should be beautiful. In some ways, it'll be reminiscent of the desert southwest, I think, with mesas and buttes and canyons and stuff like that. And as we start driving up into this mound of sedimentary rocks, it should really be visually spectacular. But maybe more importantly, it'll be like a hike through the Grand Canyon, in that we'll see all these layers exposed, and we'll be reading the book of the Martian past as we drive up into the layers. So it could be really exciting.
That answers the questions I had, but was there anything else that you'd like to add that I did not ask you about?
I'd just like to encourage people to stay involved, follow along, send in your Q&A to mission team people on these various websites, and be part of the adventure, because it really is an adventure.
Well, great. Well, thank you very much, Jim. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Great talking with you.